conditions proved too dangerous. The three desperate men stood on the beach, increasingly fearful that their rescuers would decide to abandon them. Finally, Chapel, the strongest of the three and the only one who knew how to swim, dove into the sea. His arms were skin and bone, but with the adrenaline coursing through him, he reached the launch and was pulled aboard. The Surrey's crew discussed what to do next. They might have to return the following day for the other two men, but Chapel refused to abandon his two shipmates even temporarily. With a rope tied around his waist, he dove into the water and swam back over the coral to the beach. One at a time, the three of them were pulled out to the boat. They suffered many cuts and bruises from the reef, but all made it to the Surrey alive. Captain Rain judged that the three of them would have been dead after another month on the island. Their clothes were mere rags. Between them, they had only a single pair of pants. Somehow, one of them had been able to save his seaman's certificate on which he had kept a record of their days spent on Henderson. They told Rain that Captain Pollard had left several letters in a box nailed to a tree, and the next day Rain was able to land on the island and retrieve the letters. The only Essex crew members not accounted for were the three men, Obed Hendricks, Joseph West, and William Bond, in the second mate's boat, which separated from Pollard's on the night of January 29th. Months later, long after Captain Rain had searched Ducie Island, the atoll to the east of Henderson, another ship touched down there. The crew discovered a whaleboat washed up on the brittle shore with four skeletons inside. In 1825, the British Navy captain Frederick William Beechey, who visited both Ducie and Henderson Islands, made the connection between this ghostly vessel of bones and the lost Essex boat. If this was indeed the second mate's whaleboat, and the skeletons belonged to Hendricks, West, Bond, and perhaps Isaiah Shepherd, the last of the crew to die before the separation from Pollard, then it had drifted for more than 1,000 miles, finally coming to rest within a day's sail of where it had started on December 27th, 1820. In 1820 to 1821, as the Essex boat crews struggled east under a blistering sun, their kin on Nantucket were suffering through one of the coldest winters in the island's history. On the day that the three whaleboats left Henderson Island, Obed Macy, Nantucket's historian, recorded in his journal that the harbor was covered with porridge ice. By January 7th, the harbor was frozen solid. Ice extended north toward the mainland as far as the eye could see. Supplies of food and especially firewood were already dangerously low. 6 feet of snow smothered the outlying areas of the island, making it impossible for the sheep to feed on grass. Macy estimated that as many as half of Nantucket's total herd of about 9,000 sheep would be dead by spring. On January 13th, 6 men from Martha's Vineyard, who were trapped on Nantucket and desperate to return to their families, launched a whaleboat from the south shore, where the ocean surf had maintained a corridor of open water. The wind remained moderate that day, and people were optimistic that the vineyarders had reached home safely. There is no record of whether or not they did. On January 25th, the temperature dropped to 12 degrees below zero, the lowest ever recorded on the island. Many people, especially the old, Macy wrote, could hardly be kept comfortable in bed. 4 men were added to the town's night watch. With almost all of the island's population crowded into a congestion of old wooden buildings, their fireplaces roaring night and day, there was a high risk of what Macy called a disastrous fire. Adding to the danger was the unusually large amount of sperm oil stored in the town's warehouses that winter. Macy noted that the merchants had taken every necessary care to preserve the oil from fire. Finally, in the beginning of February, the temperature rose above freezing and it began to rain. "The ice and snow melts away rapidly," Macy wrote, "which seems to animate and give life to business of most kinds. The vessels and men who have been confined here for some weeks begin to move, with some prospects of being released from prison. The people who were so anxious to get off are cutting out the mail packet from the ice." On the morning of February 4th, the packet sailed from Nantucket with the largest mail packages that ever went from here at one time. On February 17th, the day before Chase's rescue, several trading vessels arrived with cargoes of corn, cranberries, hay, fresh pork, beef, turkey, cider, dry fish, and apples. The crisis was over. The families of the Essex crew members had no reason for concern throughout the winter and spring. Letters mailed from the Galapagos post office on Charles Island in late October would not have reached Nantucket until February or March at the earliest. They would have told of a typical whaling voyage reaching its midpoint, with hopes high that a productive season in the offshore ground would allow them to return home in the summer of 1822. What the people of Nantucket did not know was that since late February, a kind of tidal wave of horror had been building in the whale fishery as the story of the Essex was passed from ship to ship, gradually making its way around the Horn and up the Atlantic toward Nantucket. Riding the crest of this wave was the Eagle, with Chase, Lawrence, Nickerson, and Ramsdell aboard. Before the Eagle's arrival, however, a letter reached Nantucket that told of the disaster. The town's post office was on Main Street, and as soon as the letter arrived, it was read there before an overflowing crowd. The islander Frederick Sanford was a contemporary of the Nantucket teenagers aboard the Essex, and he would never forget what he saw and heard that day. The letter, Sanford recalled, told of their sufferings in the boats, eating each other, and some of them, my old playmates at school. Despite Nantucket's reputation for Quaker stoicism, the people assembled outside the post office could not conceal their emotions. Everyone was overcome by the letter's recital, Sanford wrote, and wept in the streets. As it turned out, the letter contained an incomplete account of the disaster. Pollard and Ramsdell had been rescued almost a week after Chase's boat crew, but their account, passed from whaleship to whaleship, was the first to make it home. The letter mentioned the three men left on the island but gave little hope for any other survivors. Pollard and Ramsdell were assumed to be the only Nantucketers left alive. On June 11th, the Eagle arrived at the Nantucket bar. My family had received the most distressing account of our shipwreck, Chase wrote, and had given me up for lost. But standing alongside Ramsdell was not George Pollard. Instead, there were three ghosts: Owen Chase, Benjamin Lawrence, and Thomas Nickerson. Tears of sorrow were soon succeeded by amazement and then tears of joy. My unexpected appearance, Chase remembered, was welcomed with the most grateful obligations and acknowledgments to a beneficent Creator who had guided me through darkness, trouble, and death once more to the bosom of my country and friends. Chase discovered that he was the father of a 14-month-old daughter, Phoebe Ann. For Chase's wife, Peggy, it was an overwhelming sight. The husband, whom she had once thought dead, holding their chubby-cheeked daughter in his still bony, scab-covered arms. The community of Nantucket was overwhelmed as well. Obed Macy, the meticulous keeper of Nantucket's historical record, chose not to mention the disaster in his journal. Although articles quickly appeared about the Essex in the New Bedford Mercury, Nantucket's own fledgling newspaper, The Inquirer, did not write about the disaster that summer. It was as if Nantucketers were refusing to commit to an opinion about the matter until they had first had a chance to hear from the Essex's captain, George Pollard, Jr. They would have to wait almost 2 months until August 5th, when Pollard returned to the island aboard the two brothers. The whale ship was first sighted by the lookout posted at the tower of the Congregational Church. As word spread down the lanes and into the grog shops and warehouses and rope walks and out into the wharves, a crowd formed and began to make its way to the cliff along the north shore. From there they could see the black, sea-worn ship, heavy with oil, her sails furled, anchored at the Nantucket bar. At 222 tons, the two brothers was even smaller than the Essex had been, and once she'd been relieved of some of her oil, she crossed the bar at high tide and made her way toward the harbor entrance. The crowd surged back to the waterfront. Soon more than 1,500 people were waiting expectantly at the wharves. The arrival of a whale ship, any whale ship, was what one Nantucketer called an era in most of our lives. It was the way people learned about the ones they loved, the sons, husbands, fathers, uncles, and friends whose workplace was on the other side of the world. Since no one knew what news the whale ship might bring, islanders greeting a ship tended to hide their eagerness and anxiety behind a veneer of solemnity. We feel a singular blending of joy and grief on such occasions, this same Nantucketer confessed. We know not whether to smile or weep. Our emotions at all events is much subdued. We dare not express it aloud, lest it grate upon the ear of some to whom this ship has been a harbinger of evil. We are disposed to be quiet. And yet, at this time, we have an irresistible impulse to utter our feelings. And so, when Pollard first stepped upon the wharf, surrounded by more than 1,000 familiar faces, there was an absolute, nerve-shattering quiet. Frederick Sanford, Nickerson's and Ramsdell's old school chum, would later describe the assembly as an awe-struck, silent crowd. As Pollard began to make his way toward home, people moved aside to let him pass. No one said a word. It was generally acknowledged that a whaling captain bore a much heavier weight of responsibility than a captain in the merchant service. In addition to navigating his vessel around the Horn and back, he was required to train a crew of inexperienced men in the dangerous art of killing and processing whales. And when it was all done, he had to answer to his ship's owners, who expected nothing less than a full hold of oil. It was little wonder, then, that a whaling captain was paid, on average, 3 times what the commander of a merchant vessel received. As a mate aboard the Essex, George Pollard had known only success. As captain, he had known only disaster. Since a whaleman was paid a portion of the proceeds at the end of the voyage, Pollard, like all the other survivors, had nothing to show for 2 years of misery and hardship. Captain Amasa Delano knew what it was like to return home after an unsuccessful voyage. It must be acknowledged that I never saw my native country with so little pleasure as on my return to it after a disastrous termination of my enterprises and my hopes, Delano wrote in an 1817 account of his many voyages to the Pacific. The shore on which I would have leaped with delight was covered with gloom and sadness to my downcast eye and wounded mind. My observation was alive to every symptom of neglect or affected pity which might appear in the conduct or salutations of my acquaintance on shore. Pollard was inevitably subjected to a lengthy interview by the Essex's owners, Gideon Folger and Paul Macy, a harrowing process during which it would have been difficult for a first-time captain not to sound defensive. It is unquestionably true that the poor and disappointed man is often too jealous on this subject, Delano wrote, and puts an erroneous and unjust construction upon conduct which is neither mercenary nor heartless. But it wasn't just the Essex's owners to whom Pollard had to answer. There was a member of his own family, Owen Coffin's mother. Nancy Bunker Coffin, 43, was Pollard's aunt, the sister of his mother, Tamar, 57. Nancy had married into one of Nantucket's oldest and proudest families, one that traced its roots to Tristram Coffin, the patriarch of the island's first English settlement in the 17th century. Nancy's father-in-law, Hezekiah Coffin Sr., had been the captain of one of the ships involved in the Boston Tea Party in 1773. Hezekiah had distinguished himself, according to family legend, as the first to throw tea into Boston Harbor. The family possessed a miniature portrait of Hezekiah. He had wide-set eyes, a sharp nose, and a gentle, slightly embarrassed smile. Although his son, Hezekiah Jr., had been a birthright friend, he'd been disowned when he married Nancy Bunker, a non-Quaker, in 1799. Then in 1812, when Owen Coffin was 10, Hezekiah Jr. officially apologized, and both he and Nancy became members of the North Meeting on Broad Street. On that August day in 1821, when George Pollard arrived on her doorstep, Nancy's commitment to her adopted faith met the severest possible test. He bore the awful message to the mother as her son desired, Nickerson wrote. Nancy Coffin did not take it well. The idea that the man to whom she had entrusted the care of her 17-year-old son was living as a consequence of her boy's death was too much for her to bear. She became almost frantic with the thought, Nickerson wrote, and I have heard that she never could become reconciled to the captain's presence. The verdict of the community was less harsh. The drawing of lots was accepted by the unwritten law of the sea as permissible in a survival situation. Captain Pollard was not thought to have dealt unfairly with this trying matter, Nickerson wrote. Although it did not involve the drawing of lots, a comparable case of survival cannibalism rocked the community of Montevideo, Uruguay in 1972. The ordeal began when a plane transporting a local soccer team to Santiago, Chile, crashed in the snowy Andes Mountains. Until their rescue, 10 weeks later, the 16 survivors sustained themselves on the frozen corpses of the passengers who had died in the crash. Just as had occurred in Nantucket more than 150 years earlier, the residents of Montevideo did not fault the young men's behavior. Soon after their return, Montevideo's Catholic Archbishop declared that since it had been a question of survival, the men were blameless, adding, "It is always necessary to eat whatever is at hand, in spite of the repugnance it may evoke." There is no evidence that Nantucket's religious leaders felt compelled to speak in defense of the Essex survivors. The fact remains, however, that no matter how justified it may have been, cannibalism was and continues to be what one scholar has termed a cultural embarrassment, an act so unsettling that it is inevitably more difficult for the general public to accept than for the survivors who resorted to it. For his own part, Pollard did not allow the horror he had experienced in the whaleboat to defeat him, displaying an honesty and directness concerning the disaster that would sustain him all his life. Captain George Worth of the Two Brothers was so impressed with the integrity of the former captain of the Essex during the 2.5-month voyage back from Valparaiso that he recommended Pollard as his replacement. Soon after his return, Pollard was formally offered command of the Two Brothers. By the time Pollard returned to Nantucket, Owen Chase had begun working on a book about the disaster. Chase had kept a daily log of his ordeal in the boats. He also appears to have obtained a copy of the letter written by the Diana's captain, Aaron Paddock, the night after hearing Pollard's story, which provided him with an account of what had happened on the other two boats after the separation on January 12th. But Owen Chase was a whaleman, not a writer. There seems no reason to suppose that Owen himself wrote the narrative Herman Melville would write in his own copy of Chase's book. It bears obvious tokens of having been written for him, but at the same time its whole air plainly evinces that it was carefully and conscientiously written to Owen's dictation of the facts. Chase had grown up with a boy who, instead of shipping out for the Pacific, had attended Harvard College. William Coffin Jr. was the 23-year-old son of a successful whale oil merchant who had also served as Nantucket's first postmaster. After graduating from Harvard, William Jr. had briefly studied medicine, and then, in the words of a friend, followed other pursuits more congenial with his enthusiastic love of literature. Years later, he would ghostwrite Obed Macy's much-praised History of Nantucket. There is also evidence that he helped write an account of the notorious Globe Mutiny. His published literary career appears to have begun, however, with the narrative of the Essex disaster. Coffin was the ideal person to work with Chase. Well-educated and an accomplished writer, Coffin also had a thorough knowledge of both Nantucket and whaling. Being Chase's own age, he could empathize with the young first mate in a way that makes the narrative read, Melville noted, as though Owen wrote it himself. The two men worked quickly and well together. By early fall, the manuscript was finished. By November 22nd, almost precisely a year after the sinking, the published book had reached shops on Nantucket. In a note to the reader, Chase claims that having lost everything in the wreck, he was desperate to make some money to support his young family. "The hope of obtaining something of remuneration," Chase wrote, "by giving a short history of my sufferings to the world, must therefore constitute my claim to public attention." But he had other motives as well. Writing the narrative offered him an opportunity to represent himself, a young officer in need of another ship, as positively as possible. Chase's account is necessarily focused on what happened on his own boat. However, the majority of the deaths, 9 out of 11, occurred on the other two boats, and Chase's description of these deaths is limited to a brief summation at the end of his narrative. It would be difficult for any reader of Chase's book alone to appreciate the true scope of the disaster. In particular, the fact that 5 out of the first 6 men to die were black is never commented on by Chase. By keeping many of the most disturbing and problematic aspects of the disaster offstage, Chase transforms the story of the Essex into a personal tale of trial and triumph. It is in his account of the decisions made prior to the ordeal in the whaleboats that the first mate is the most self-serving. He chooses not to mention that he was the one, along with Matthew Joy, who urged Captain Pollard to continue on after the knockdown in the Gulf Stream, even though several whaleboats had been lost. He also makes the officer's decision to sail for South America sound as if it were mutually agreed upon from the start, when, according to Nickerson, Pollard had initially proposed to sail for the Society Islands. More important, Chase is careful to conceal that he had the opportunity to lance the whale after the first attack, a fact that would not be revealed until the publication of Nickerson's account 163 years later. Chase's fellow Nantucket survivors, particularly Captain Pollard, undoubtedly felt that their side of the story had not been adequately told in the first mate's account of the disaster. Herman Melville would later report that Pollard had been moved to write, or caused to be written under his own name, his own version of the story, a narrative that has not come to light. But it wasn't just Chase's fellow crew members who felt slighted by the publication of the Essex narrative. As Ralph Waldo Emerson would observe during a visit to the island in 1847, Nantucketers are very sensitive to everything that dishonors the island because it hurts the value of stock till the company are poorer. The last thing they wanted placed before the nation and the world was a detailed account of how some of their own men and boys had been reduced to cannibalism. Chase's account pulled no punches on this issue, employing two exclamation marks when it came to the initial proposal to eat Isaac Cole. No matter how straitened a man's circumstances, many believed, he did not attempt to enrich himself by sensationalizing the sufferings of his own people. Significantly, Chase's next voyage would not be on a Nantucket whale ship. That December, he traveled to New Bedford, where he sailed as first mate on the Florida, a whale ship without a single Nantucketer in the crew. Even though his family remained on the island, Chase would not sail on a ship from his home port for another 11 years. George Pollard, however, was given the ultimate vote of confidence. On November 26, 1821, a little more than 3 months after returning to Nantucket and just a few days after the appearance of Chase's narrative, he set sail for the Pacific as captain of the two brothers. But perhaps the most extraordinary endorsement Pollard received came from two of his crew members. For Pollard wasn't the only Essex man aboard the two brothers. Two others had chosen to serve under him again. One was Thomas Nickerson. The other was Charles Ramsdell, the boy who had spent 94 days in a whaleboat with him. If there was someone who had come to know Captain Pollard, it was Charles Ramsdell. Chapter 14. Consequences. George Pollard took to his second command with optimism that was remarkable, considering what had happened to his first. In the winter of 1822, he successfully brought the two brothers around the Horn, headed her up the west coast of South America, and provisioned her at the Peruvian port of Payta. In mid-August, the two brothers spoke the U.S. Navy schooner Water Witch. Aboard the Water Witch was a 24-year-old midshipman named Charles Wilkes. As it so happened, Wilkes had finished reading Chase's narrative of the Essex disaster only the day before. He asked the captain of the two brothers if he was any relation to the famous George Pollard of Nantucket. Pollard said that yes, he was the same man. "This made a great impression on me," Wilkes said many years later. Even though Wilkes had already read the published account, Pollard insisted on telling the young midshipman his own version of the story. It was to be expected that some effect of his former cruise would have been visible in his manner of conversation, Wilkes wrote, but not so. He was cheerful and very modest in his account. The midshipman judged Pollard to be a hero, who did not even consider that he had overcome obstacles which would have crushed 99 out of 100. But there was at least one indication that Pollard had not emerged from the ordeal entirely unscathed. Wilkes noted an unusual feature in the captain's cabin. Attached to the ceiling was a large amount of netting, and it was filled with provisions, primarily potatoes and other fresh vegetables. Captain Pollard, the man who had almost starved to death only the year before, could now simply reach over his head and pull down something to eat. Wilkes asked Pollard how, after all that he had suffered, he could dare go to sea again. He simply remarked, Wilkes wrote, that it was an old adage that the lightning never struck in the same place twice. But in the case of Captain Pollard, it did. In February of 1823, the two brothers and another Nantucket whale ship, the Martha, were sailing west together toward a new whaling ground. In the few years since the start of Pollard's previous voyage, much had changed in the Pacific whale fishery. Soon after the opening up of the offshore ground in 1819, Nantucket whale ships had stopped at the Hawaiian island of Oahu for the first time. That same year, Frederick Coffin, captain of the Siren, laid claim to discovering the rich Japan ground. All of the Pacific, not just its eastern and western edges, had become the domain of the Nantucket whalemen. The two brothers and the Martha were several hundred miles west of the Hawaiian Islands, headed toward the Japan ground when it began to blow. Pollard ordered his men to shorten sail. It was raining hard, and in the high seas, the two brothers was proving difficult to steer. The Martha was the faster of the two whale ships, and as night came on, the lookout of the two brothers could barely see her from the masthead. They were sailing at about the same latitude as French frigate Shoals, a deadly maze of rocks and coral reefs to the northwest of the Hawaiian Islands, but both Pollard and Captain John Pease of the Martha judged themselves to be well to the west of danger. Since his previous voyage, Pollard had learned how to determine his ship's longitude by lunar observation. However, owing to overcast skies, it had been more than 10 days since he had been able to take a lunar, so he had to rely on dead reckoning to determine his ship's position. It was blowing so hard that the whaleboats had been taken off the davits and lashed to the deck. That night, one of the officers remarked that the water alongside looked wider than usual. Thomas Nickerson was about to retrieve a jacket from down below when he noticed Pollard standing on the ship's railing, staring down worriedly into the sea. While Nickerson was below decks, the ship struck something with a fearful crash, and he was thrown to the floor. Nickerson assumed they had collided with another ship. "Judge of my astonishment," he wrote, "to find ourselves surrounded with breakers apparently mountains high, and our ship careening over upon her broadside and thumping so heavily that one could scarcely stand upon his feet." The ship was being pounded to pieces on a coral reef. Captain Pollard seemed to stand amazed at the scene before him, Nickerson remembered. First Mate Eben Gardner leaped into the breach. He ordered the men to begin cutting down the masts in hopes of saving the ship. Realizing that the spars would likely fall across and crush the whaleboats tied to the deck, Pollard finally came to life. He commanded the crew to put away their axes and begin readying the boats. "Had the masts of the ship been cut away at that time," Nickerson wrote, "I would probably have adorned this tale instead of told it." But by the time the men began crowding into the two boats, Pollard had lapsed into his former state of mesmerized despair. His reasoning powers had flown, Nickerson remembered, and the captain appeared unwilling to leave the ship. The waves threatened to bash the boats against the hull as the men pleaded with their commander to save himself. Captain Pollard reluctantly got into the boat, Nickerson wrote, just as they were about to shove off from the ship. Nickerson, who at 17 years old had been promoted to boat steerer, was standing at the steering oar when a huge wave slammed into the boat and threw him into the sea. One of the mates reached out to him with a blade of the after oar. Nickerson grabbed it and was pulled back into the boat. The two whaleboats were quickly separated in the darkness. "Our boat seemed to be surrounded with breakers," Nickerson remembered, "and we were compelled to row between them all night, for we could see no outlet." The next morning they saw a ship anchored in the lee of a 50-foot-high rock. It proved to be the Martha, which had narrowly escaped crashing into the rock the night before. Soon both boat crews had been rescued, and the Martha was on her way to Oahu. 2 months later, in the harbor of Raiatea, one of the Society Islands, a missionary named George Bennett boarded the U.S. brig Pearl, bound for Boston. Among the passengers was George Pollard. The 31-year-old captain had greatly changed since he'd talked to Charles Wilkes less than a year before. His former cheerfulness had disappeared. Yet, anchored in the harbor of an island that he and his men had once spurned in the mistaken fear of cannibals, he insisted on telling Bennett the story of the Essex in painful detail. This time, when it came to describing the execution of Owen Coffin, he broke off. "But I can tell you no more," he cried out to Bennett. "My head is on fire at the recollection. I hardly know what I say." Pollard finished the conversation by relating how he had recently lost his second whale ship on a shoal off the Hawaiian Islands. Then, in what Bennett called a tone of despondency never to be forgotten by him who heard it, Pollard confessed, "Now I am utterly ruined. No owner will ever trust me with a whaler again, for all will say I am an unlucky man." As Pollard predicted, his whaling career was over. The island that had rallied so quickly behind him after the sinking of the Essex now turned its back. He had become a Jonah, a twice-doomed captain whom no one dared give a third chance. After returning to his wife, Mary, Pollard made a single voyage in a merchant vessel out of New York. But not liking that business, Nickerson wrote, he returned to his home on Nantucket. He became a night watchman, a position on the lowest rung of the island's social ladder. A disturbing rumor began to be whispered about the streets of town, a rumor that was still being told on Nantucket almost 100 years later. It had not been Owen Coffin who had drawn the short piece of paper the gossip mongers claimed. It had been George Pollard. It was only then that his young cousin, already near death and convinced he would not last the night, offered and even insisted on taking the captain's place. If the rumor had it right, Pollard was not only unlucky, he was a coward, and fate had found him out. The word Pollard has two meanings. A pollard is an animal, such as an ox, goat, or sheep, that has lost its horns. But pollard is also a gardening term. To pollard a tree is to prune back its branches severely so that it may produce a dense growth of new shoots. Misfortune had pollarded George Pollard, cutting back his possibilities. But, as if strengthened by the surgery, he created a happy, meaningful life for himself in his native town. George and Mary Pollard would never have any children of their own, but it might be said that they presided over the largest family on Nantucket. As the town's night watchman, Pollard was responsible for enforcing the 9 o'clock curfew, a duty that brought him into contact with nearly every young person on the island. Instead of becoming the dour, embittered man one might expect, he was known for his buoyant, even cheerful manner. Joseph Warren Finney was part of the Pollards' extended family. When Finney's mother and father died, he came to Nantucket to live with his grandparents. His father's first wife had been married Pollard's sister, and late in life, Finney left an account of George Pollard. "He was a short, fat man," Finney recalled, "jolly, loving the good things in life." Finney fondly remembered how Mary Pollard would lay her husband down on the kitchen table and measure him for a new pair of pants. Instead of a harpoon, this former whaleman wandered the streets with a long hickory pole with an iron hook at the end under his arm. The pole not only enabled him to adjust the town's whale oil street lamps, but proved useful in persuading the children to be in their homes by the curfew. Pollard took his duties so seriously that he was known, according to Finney, as the town gumshoe, a streetwise detective familiar with the intimate details of an island whose population would grow from 7,000 to 10,000 over the next 2 decades. Finney, like every other Nantucketer, knew the story of the Essex and had even heard the rumor about how the man who drew the lot had his place taken by a young boy. To Finney and everyone else who actually knew Pollard, it was impossible that this man could have been George Pollard. According to the version of the rumor Finney heard, the man whose place was taken by Owen Coffin had a wife and babies, and as everyone knew, the Pollards were childless. There was another rumor about Captain Pollard. It claimed that a newly arrived off-islander innocently asked him if he had ever known a man named Owen Coffin. "Know him?" Pollard was reputed to have replied. "Why, I et him." Pollard's friends didn't credit that story either. They knew that he was incapable of mocking the memory of the men who had died in the Essex whaleboats. Even though he had been able to put the tragedy behind him, he never ceased to honor those who had been lost. Once a year, Finney remembered, on the anniversary of the loss of the Essex, he locked himself in his room and fasted. As a whaleman, Owen Chase would enjoy the success that had eluded George Pollard. His personal life, however, proved less fortunate. Chase's first voyage after the sinking of the Essex as first mate aboard the New Bedford whale ship Florida lasted less than 2 years and reaped 2,000 barrels of oil. When he returned to Nantucket in 1823, he found a second child, Lydia, toddling in the wake of her older sister Phoebe Ann, now approaching 4. Chase chose to remain on island for the birth of his next child, a son who was named William Henry. Owen's wife, Peggy, did not recover from the delivery. She died less than 2 weeks later. Owen was now a 27-year-old widower with 3 children to care for. In the fall and winter of 1824 to 1825, he came to know a woman with whom he already shared a special bond. Nancy Slade Joy was the widow of Matthew Joy, second mate of the Essex. She and Matthew had been married for 2 years before her husband had shipped out for the last time. In June of 1825, 9 months after the death of Peggy Chase, the widow and widower were married, and Nancy became the stepmother of Owen's 3 children. 2 weeks later, Chase purchased a house from his father on the outskirts of Orange Street's Captain's Row. In early August, Chase sailed for New Bedford, where he took command of his first vessel, the Winslow. He was 28 years old, the same age Pollard had been when he had become captain of the Essex. The Winslow was a small whale ship and carried only 15 men. On July 20th, 1827, after a voyage of almost 2 years, she returned to New Bedford with 1,440 barrels of oil. Chase returned to Nantucket, paid off the $500 mortgage on his house, and was back in New Bedford by the second week in August. The emotions of Nancy Chase, who had lived with her husband for less than 2 months back in the summer of 1825, can only be imagined when she learned that Owen was departing almost immediately on another voyage aboard the Winslow. Soon after her departure, the Winslow was damaged in a tremendous gale and limped back to New Bedford in October for repairs. The owners decided to take the opportunity to enlarge the ship to 263 tons, allowing Chase to spend 9 months with his wife and 3 children back on Nantucket. Leaving again in July 1828, he filled his newly modified ship in 2 years and was back on Nantucket in the summer of 1830. It is naturally tempting to read into Chase's post-Essex career an Ahab-like quest for revenge. There is, in fact, a tiny shred of evidence to indicate that even if Chase was not motivated by a desire to find and kill the whale that had sunk the Essex, other whalemen said he was. In 1834, 17 years before the publication of Moby Dick, the poet and essayist Ralph Waldo Emerson shared a coach with a sailor who told of a whale, and a white whale at that, known for bashing up whaleboats with its jaw. The seaman claimed that a whale ship had been fitted out of New Bedford called the Winslow, or the Essex, he wasn't sure which, to kill this whale, and that the creature had been finally dispatched off the coast of South America. One can only wonder if Emerson recorded a garbled account of how Owen Chase, the new captain of the Winslow and the former first mate of the Essex, succeeded in avenging himself on the whale that had caused him so much hardship and pain. Whatever the case may be, Chase's almost decade-long professional banishment from Nantucket ended soon after his return from his second full voyage as captain of the Winslow. At the age of 33, he was offered command of what was to be one of the largest ships in the Nantucket whale fishery. Until then, almost all the island's ships were built on the mainland in places such as Rochester and Hanover, Massachusetts. But whaling had brought a tremendous surge of wealth to the island. The profit margins were now high enough that it was deemed economically feasible to build a whale ship at the island's Brant Point shipyard, even though all the materials had to be transported across Nantucket Sound. Over the next 2 years, the 376-ton, copper-fastened whale ship Charles Carroll took shape under Chase's experienced eye, and with an investment of $625, he was given a 1/32nd owner's share in the vessel. Chase's first voyage as captain of the Charles Carroll was a financial success. After 3.5 years, he returned in March 1836 with 2,610 barrels of oil, almost twice the return of his first voyage as captain aboard the Winslow. But the voyage came at a great personal cost. 9 months after her husband left the island, Nancy Chase gave birth to a daughter, Adeline. A few weeks later, Nancy was dead. Greeting their father at the wharf in the spring of 1836 were Phoebe Ann, almost 16, Lydia, 13, William Henry, 11, and Adeline, 2.5, a girl who had no memory of her mother and had never known her father. Chase wasn't home a month before he had remarried. Eunice Chadwick was just 27 years old, and she now had 4 stepchildren to care for. By the end of August, after less than 5 months of marriage, she was waving goodbye to her new husband. This was to be Chase's last voyage as a whaling captain. He was 40 years old, and if all went well, would be able to retire to his house on Orange Street. Also in the Pacific during this period was a young man whose whaling career was just beginning. Herman Melville first signed on in 1840 as a hand aboard the New Bedford whale ship, Acushnet. During a gam in the Pacific, he met a Nantucketer by the name of William Henry Chase, Owen Chase's teenage son. Melville had already heard stories about the Essex from the sailors aboard the Acushnet and closely questioned the boy about his father's experiences. The next morning, William pulled out a copy of Owen's Essex narrative from his sea chest and loaned it to Melville. The reading of this wondrous story upon the landless sea, Melville remembered, and so close to the very latitude of the shipwreck, had a surprising effect upon me. Later in the voyage, during a gam with another whale ship, Melville caught a glimpse of a Nantucket whaling captain whom he was told was none other than Owen Chase. He was a large, powerful, well-made man, Melville would later write in the back pages of his own copy of Chase's narrative. Rather tall, to all appearances something past 45 or so, with a handsome face for a Yankee, and expressive of great uprightness and calm, unostentatious courage. His whole appearance impressed me pleasantly. He was the most prepossessing-looking whale hunter I think I ever saw. Although Melville appears to have mistaken another whaling captain for Chase, his description is remarkably similar to a surviving portrait of Owen Chase. It depicts a confident, almost arrogant face, a man completely at ease with the responsibility of command. But Chase's professional assurance would not prepare him for the news he heard midway through his final voyage. 16 months after her husband sailed aboard the Charles Carroll, Eunice Chase, Owen Chase's third wife, gave birth to a son, Charles Frederick. Herman Melville would be told of how Chase received the news, and inevitably the future author of Moby Dick would compare the plight of the former first mate of the Essex to that of George Pollard. The miserable pertinaciousness of misfortune which pursued Pollard the captain in his second disastrous and entire shipwreck did likewise hunt poor Owen, Melville wrote, though somewhat more dilatory in overtaking him the second time. Melville was told that Chase had received letters informing him of the certain infidelity of his wife. We also heard that his receipt of this news had told most heavily upon Chase, and that he was a prey to the deepest gloom. A matter of days after his return to Nantucket in the winter of 1840, Chase filed for divorce. On July 7th, the divorce was granted, with Chase taking over legal guardianship of Charles Frederick. 2 months later, Chase was married for the fourth time to Susan Coffin Gwynn. In the previous 21 years, he had spent only 5 at home. He would now remain on Nantucket for the rest of his life. The other Essex survivors also returned to the sea. Once they'd been delivered to Oahu after the wreck of the two brothers, Thomas Nickerson and Charles Ramsdell soon found berths on other whale ships. In the 1840s, Ramsdell served as captain of the General Jackson out of Bristol, Rhode Island. He would marry twice and have a total of 6 children. Nickerson eventually tired of the whaling life and became a captain in the merchant service, relocating to Brooklyn, New York, where he and his wife, Margaret, lived for a number of years. They had no children. Benjamin Lawrence served as captain of the whale ships Dromo and Huron, the latter out of Hudson, New York, home of the Essex's second mate, Matthew Joy. Lawrence had 7 children, one of whom would die at sea. In the early 1840s, Lawrence, like Chase, retired from the whaling business and purchased a small farm at Syosconset on the east end of the island of Nantucket. Less is known about the three off-islanders rescued from Henderson Island. The two Cape Codders, Seth Weeks and William Wright, continued as crew members on the Surrey, voyaging throughout the Pacific until they made their way to England and back to the United States. Wright was lost at sea in a hurricane off the West Indies. Weeks eventually retired to Cape Cod, where he would outlive all the other Essex survivors. The Englishman Thomas Chapel returned to London in June 1823. There he contributed to a religious tract that wrung every possible spiritual lesson from the story of the Essex disaster. Nickerson later heard of the Englishman's death on the fever-plagued island of Timor. Although townspeople continued to whisper about the Essex well into the 20th century, it was not a topic a Nantucketer openly discussed. When the daughter of Benjamin Lawrence was asked about the disaster, she replied, "We do not mention this in Nantucket." It wasn't just the fact that the men had resorted to cannibalism. It was also difficult for Nantucketers to explain why the first four men to be eaten had been African American. What made this a particularly sensitive topic on Nantucket was the island's reputation as an abolitionist stronghold, what the poet John Greenleaf Whittier called a refuge of the free. Instead of the Essex, Nantucket's Quakers preferred to talk about how the island's growing black community to the south of town, known as New Guinea, participated in the booming whaling economy. In 1830, Captain Obed Starbuck and his almost all-black crew returned after a voyage of only 14 and a half months with 2,280 barrels of oil. A headline in the Nantucket Inquirer announced, "Greatest voyage ever made." Spirits ran so high that the black sailors and the crew paraded up Main Street, proudly shouldering their harpoons and lances. Less than 10 years later, an escaped slave living in New Bedford was invited to speak at an abolitionist meeting at the island's Athenaeum Library. The African-American's name was Frederick Douglass, and his appearance on Nantucket marked the first time he had ever spoken before a white audience. This was the legacy Nantucket's Quaker hierarchy wanted the world to remember, not the disturbing events associated with the Essex. For a time, at least, off-islanders seemed to have forgotten about the tragedy. In 1824, Samuel Comstock led the crew of the Nantucket whaleship Globe in a bloody mutiny, and public attention was directed away from the Essex. 10 years later, however, with the publication of an article about the wreck in the North American Review, interest returned. Over the next two decades, numerous accounts of the Essex disaster appeared. One of the most influential versions of the story was included in a popular children's schoolbook, William H. McGuffey's The Eclectic Fourth Reader. It would become difficult to grow up in America without learning some form of the Essex story. In 1834, Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote in his journal of his conversation with the seaman about the white whale and the Essex. When Emerson visited Nantucket in 1847, he met Captain Pollard and, in a letter to his young daughter back home in Concord, Massachusetts, described the sinking of the Essex. A great sperm whale was seen coming with full speed toward the vessel. In a moment, he struck the ship with terrible force, staving in some planks and causing a leak. Then he went off a little way and came back swiftly, the water all white with his violent motion, and struck the ship a second frightful blow. In 1837, Edgar Allan Poe made use of the more ghoulish aspects of Chase's account in his narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym. Lots are drawn, men are eaten, and one sailor dies in horrible convulsions. Decades before the Donner Party became snowbound in the foothills of the Sierras, the Essex brought a scandalous tale of cannibalism to the American public. But it would be left to Herman Melville to make the most enduring use of the whaleship's story. Moby Dick contains several detailed references to the attack of the whale on the Essex, but it is the climax of the novel that draws most heavily on Chase's narrative. Retribution, swift vengeance, eternal malice were in his whole aspect, Melville writes of the white whale's assault on the Pequod. Upon impact, the whale, just as Chase describes in his account, dives beneath the ship and runs, quivering, along its keel. But instead of attacking the already sinking ship for a second time, Moby Dick turns his attention to the whaleboat of Captain Ahab. Moby Dick proved to be both a critical and financial disappointment, and in 1852, a year after its publication, Melville finally visited Nantucket. He traveled to the island in July with his father-in-law, Justice Lemuel Shaw, the same judge who had granted Owen Chase's divorce 12 years earlier. Like Emerson before him, it wasn't Chase, now a retired whaling captain living off the income from his investments, whom Melville sought out, but rather George Pollard, the lowly night watchman. Melville appears to have stayed at the Ocean House on the corner of Center and Broad Streets, diagonally across from the home in which George and Mary Pollard had been living for decades. Late in life, Melville wrote of the Essex's captain, "To the islanders, he was a nobody. To me, the most impressive man, though wholly unassuming, even humble, that I ever encountered." In the years to come, Melville's professional life as a novelist would go the way of Pollard's whaling career. Without a readership for his books, the author of Moby Dick was forced to take a job as a customs inspector on the wharves of New York City. Although he ceased writing novels, he continued to write poetry, in particular a long, dark poem called Clairol, in which there is a character based on Pollard. After two disastrous voyages, the former captain becomes a night patrolman on the quay, watching the bales till morning hour, through fair and foul. Melville felt a powerful kinship with the captain of the Essex, and his description of the old seaman is based as much upon himself as it is on the man he met on the streets of Nantucket. Never he smiled. Call him and he would come. Not sour in spirit, but meek and reconciled. Patient he was, he none withstood. Oft on some secret thing would brood. By 1835, when Obed Macy published, with the assistance of William Coffin, Jr., his History of Nantucket, New Bedford had eclipsed the island as America's leading whaling port. The Nantucket Bar, a mere nuisance in the early days of the Pacific whale fishery, had developed into a major obstacle to prosperity. The whale ships had become so large that they could no longer cross the bar without being almost completely unloaded by lighters, a time-consuming and expensive process. In 1842, Peter Folger Ewer designed and built two 135-foot camels, giant wooden water wings that formed a floating dry dock capable of carrying a fully loaded whale ship across the bar. The fact remained, however, that New Bedford's deep water harbor gave the port an unassailable advantage, as did its nearness to the newly emerging railroad system, on which increasing numbers of merchants shipped their oil to market. But Nantucketers also had themselves to blame for the dramatic downturn the whaling business would take on the island in the 1840s. As whalemen from New Bedford, New London, and Sag Harbor opened up new whaling grounds in the North Pacific, Nantucketers stuck stubbornly to the long-since depleted grounds that had served them so well in past decades. There were also problems at home. Quakerism, once the driving cultural and spiritual force of the community, fractured into several squabbling sects. Throughout the 1830s and 1840s, there were more meeting houses than ever on the island, yet the total number of Quakers on Nantucket dwindled with each passing year. As the strictures of Quakerism relaxed, Nantucketers were free to display the wealth they had once felt obliged to conceal. Main Street became lined with elegant brick estates and giant clabbered Greek Revival mansions, monuments to the riches islanders had, in the words of Herman Melville, harpooned and dragged up hither from the bottom of the sea. Even though the annual return of oil had been steadily diminishing for a number of years, there was little visible reason for concern on the streets of Nantucket in the early summer of 1846. Then at 11 o'clock on a hot July night, someone shouted the dreaded word, "Fire!" It had been one of the driest summers on record. The wooden buildings were as parched as tinder. In a few short minutes, the flames had spread from a hat factory on Main Street to an adjoining structure. At this time, Nantucket was without a municipal fire department, relying instead on privately organized fire companies. As the fire made its way up Main Street with alarming rapidity, individual homeowners started bidding for the fire company's services so as to protect their own houses. Instead of working together as a coordinated unit, the companies split off in different directions, allowing the blaze to build into an uncontrollable conflagration. The immense upward flow of heat created wind currents that rushed through the narrow streets, spreading the fire in all directions. Chunks of burning debris flew into the air and landed on houses that had been assumed safe. In an attempt to contain the blaze, the town's fire wardens dynamited houses, the explosions adding to the terrifying confusion of the night. Owen Chase's Orange Street home was far enough south to escape the fire, but Pollard's house on Center Street was directly in its path. Miraculously, the tornado-like convection currents turned the fire east toward the harbor before it reached the night watchman's house. Pollard's residence survived even though all the houses on the east side of the street were destroyed. Soon the fire reached the waterfront. Oil warehouses billowed with black smoke, then erupted into flame. As the casks burst, a river of liquid fire poured across the wharves and into the harbor. One fire company had run its engine into the shallows of the anchorage and was pumping seawater onto the wharves. The men belatedly realized that a creeping slick of oil had surrounded them in fire. Their only option was to dive underwater and swim for their lives. Their wooden fire engine was destroyed, but all the men made it to safety. By the next morning, more than a third of the town, and almost all the commercial district, was a charred wasteland. But it was the waterfront that had suffered the most. The sperm oil had burned so fiercely that not even cinders remained. The Leviathan, it was said, had finally achieved his revenge. The town was quickly rebuilt, this time largely in brick. Nantucketers attempted to reassure themselves that the disturbing dip in the whaling business was only temporary. Then, just 2 years later, in 1848, came the discovery of gold in California. Hundreds of Nantucketers surrendered to the lure of easy wealth in the West. Abandoning careers as whalemen, they shipped out as passengers bound for San Francisco, packed into the same ships in which they had once pursued the mighty sperm whale. The Golden Gate became the burial ground of countless Nantucket whale ships, abandoned by their crews and left to rot on the mudflats. Long before Edwin Drake struck oil in Titusville, Pennsylvania in 1859, Nantucket's economic fate had been determined. Over the next 20 years, the island's population would shrink from 10,000 to 3,000. "Nantucket now has a body of death appearance, such as few New England towns possess," one visitor wrote. "The houses stand around in faded gentility style. The inhabitants have a dreamy look, as though they live in the memories of the past." Even though whaling would continue out of New Bedford into the 1920s, the island whose name had once been synonymous with the fishery had ceased to be an active whaling port only 40 years after the departure of the Essex. On November 16, 1869, Nantucket's last whaling vessel, the Oak, left the harbor, never to return. The world's sperm whale population proved remarkably resilient in the face of what Melville called so remorseless a havoc. It is estimated that the Nantucketers and their Yankee whale-killing brethren harvested more than 225,000 sperm whales between 1804 and 1876. In 1837, the best year in the century for killing whales, 6,767 sperm whales were taken by American whalemen. As a disturbing point of comparison, in 1964, the peak year of modern whaling, 29,255 sperm whales were killed. Some researchers believe that by the 1860s, whalemen may have reduced the world's sperm whale population by as much as 75%. Others claim it was diminished by only 8 to 18%. Whatever figure is closer to the truth, sperm whales have done better than other large cetaceans hunted by man. Today there are between 1.5 to 2 million sperm whales, making them the most abundant of the world's great whales. As late as 1845, whalemen were confident that the sperm whale stocks were in no danger of diminishing. They did comment, however, on how the behavior of the whales had changed. "They have indeed become wilder," one observer wrote, "or, as some of the whalers express it, more scary, and in consequence not so easy to capture." Like the whale that had attacked the Essex, an increasing number of sperm whales were fighting back. In 1835, the crew of the English whale ship Pusey Hall were forced into full retreat by what they termed a fighting whale. After driving away four whaleboats, the whale pursued them back to the ship. The men hurled several lances at the whale before it could be induced to retire. In 1836, The Lydia, a Nantucket whale ship, was struck and sunk by a sperm whale, as was the two generals a few years later. In 1850, the Pocahontas, out of Martha's Vineyard, was rammed by a whale but was able to reach port for repairs. Then in 1851, the year that Moby Dick was published, a whale ship was attacked by a sperm whale in the same waters where the Essex had been sunk 31 years before. The Anne Alexander, a whale ship out of New Bedford, was under the command of one of the fishiest captains in the Pacific, John de Blois. In a letter to the ship's owner, de Blois boasted that he had succeeded in killing every whale he had ever fastened to. But in August of 1851, just to the south of the equator and about 500 miles east of the Galapagos, Captain de Blois met his match. It was a large, solitary bull, what de Blois called a noble fellow. Two boats were lowered and the fight was on. Almost immediately, the whale rushed after the mate's boat. In an instant, the boat was crushed like so much paper in his mighty jaws, de Blois wrote. After rescuing the first mate's crew, de Blois was joined by the second mate in another whale boat. They divided the men among them and resumed the chase. Almost immediately, however, the whale attacked the mate's boat and immediately destroyed it. De Blois was forced to stop the pursuit, pick up the scattered crew, and return to the Anne Alexander. By this point, de Blois recounted, my blood was up, and I was fully determined to have that whale, cost what it might. As he stood at the ship's bow with a lance in his hand, the captain told the helmsman where to steer. The whale was, de Blois wrote, an artful beast, allowing them to gain only to hurry ahead before the captain could throw his weapon. Suddenly, the whale sank, then turned and surfaced only yards in front of the ship. De Blois hurled the lance, but it was too late. The whale's massive head struck the bow of the ship, knocking de Blois off his feet. Convinced that the Anne Alexander had been stove, he ran below to check for damage, but all proved tight. De Blois ordered his men to lower another boat. The mate objected, insisting that to do so would be suicide. Since it was already close to dusk, de Blois reluctantly decided to wait until morning. Just as I gave these orders, the captain remembered, I caught a glimpse of a shadow, as it seemed to me. It was the whale, hurtling through the water toward the Anne Alexander. It struck the ship a terrible blow, de Blois wrote, that shook her from stem to stern. Even before he went below to inspect the damage, he could hear water pouring into the hold. The captain rushed to his cabin to get the navigational instruments they would need in the whaleboats. As the mates readied the two remaining boats, de Blois went below one more time, but the cabin was so full of water that he was forced to swim to safety. By the time he returned to the deck, both whaleboats had rowed clear of the ship. He leaped from the railing and swam to the mate's boat. Almost immediately, his men began, in de Blois' words, to upbraid me, saying, "Oh, Captain, you ran too much risk of our lives." "Men," I replied, "for God's sake, don't find fault with me. You were as anxious as I to catch that whale, and I hadn't the least idea that anything like this would happen." The next morning they returned to the wreck. As soon as de Blois scrambled up the side, he saw the prints of the whale's teeth on the copper. The hole was just the size of the whale's head. As de Blois cut away the masts to right the ship's bell continued to clang with the rhythmic heave of the sea. A more mournful sound never fell on my ears, he remembered. It was as though it was tolling for our deaths. The ship was almost completely submerged, and the waves broke over the captain's head. Eventually, he was joined by the mate, and the two of them attempted to cut through the deck and locate some provisions and fresh water. By noon, about half the crew of 24 had found the courage to climb aboard the wreck and search for food. Several of the men had begun to grumble that they should immediately set sail for the Marquesas, 2,000 miles to the west. De Blois told the crew to assemble at the rail of the ship, where he asked if they wanted me to advise them. A majority of the men nodded their heads. Although he knew it wasn't what they wanted to hear, he told them that there weren't enough provisions to reach the Marquesas. Instead, they should sail their boats, which possessed centerboards, north toward the equator, where they might be spotted by a ship bound for California. Begrudgingly, the men agreed. Before they left, de Blois took up a nail and scratched a message into the ship's taffrail. "Save us. We poor souls have gone in two boats to the north on the wind." The mate had 12 men in his boat, the captain 13. The crew wanted to stay together, but once again Deblois overruled them. "No," says I, "my object is to have one boat go ahead if it sails faster, and the other follow in the same course, so that if the first boat is picked up, say, 100 miles ahead, their rescuers can bear down to the other boat." "Our parting was a solemn sight," he wrote, "if ever there was one in this world. We never expected to meet again on earth, and the strong men who had braved all sorts of dangers broke down and wept like children." The mate's boat soon surged ahead. It wasn't long before Deblois' men became clamorous for food. They had had nothing to eat or drink for 24 hours, but their captain felt it was too early to begin eating what little food they had. "My mind was filled with all the stories I had ever heard of shipwrecks," he remembered, "where the famishing men had been often driven to eating their shipmates' bodies." He thought, of course, of the Essex and how some of the men had drawn lots. "Pictures of this sort were enough to drive one wild," he wrote, when he felt that the same ordeal was before him. At dusk, Deblois stood up on the stern of his whaleboat for one final look before darkness came on. In the distance, ahead of the mate's boat, he saw the sail of a ship. "I tried to sing out, 'Sail ho!'" he recalled, "but I couldn't speak a word." By nightfall, all of the crew were safely aboard the whale ship Nantucket. 5 months later, the crew of the Rebecca Sims succeeded in killing the whale that sank the Anne Alexander. By then, the bull appeared old, tired, and diseased. Its sides were shaggy with twisted harpoons and lances. Huge splinters were found embedded in its head. The whale yielded between 70 and 80 barrels of oil. When Herman Melville received word of the sinking of the Anne Alexander, he could not help but wonder if the writing of his Essex-based novel had mystically conjured up the reappearance of a ship-ramming whale. "Ye gods," he wrote a friend, "what a commentator is this Anne Alexander whale! I wonder if my evil art has raised this monster." Nantucket,